Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 66 for July 4th, 2008. Jumping the Obese Monolith. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/windows. And by GoToMeeting, the easy and affordable way to conduct an online meeting. Setup takes 2 minutes, meet as often as you want for one low rate. Try GoToMeeting free. Visit GoToMeeting.com/windowsweekly. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. It's time for Windows Weekly, in which we talk about all the latest from Microsoft, from Redmond, whether it be Windows, Xbox, Home Server, Microsoft Exchange Server. I could go on and on, but let's not. Let's just say hello to Paul Thurrott, the major domo at the Supersite for Windows. Winsupersite.com. Hello, Paul. Did you make it home safe and sound?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, I had a very long day that day. I calculated driving home from the airport after we arrived that it was exactly 12 hours after we left the hotel.
Wow.
Thanks to, you know, weather. Anything delays flights now. There's a
storm
in Chicago. We're going to, you know, wait.
Flying is no fun anymore.
No. Was it ever fun? I don't even remember.
Yeah, it was fun. For a while, you know, you'd put on white gloves and a hat. And
if you want that experience, by the way, take the Amtrak and go first class.
Really? Is it still that way?
Yeah. It's still that way. Yeah.
I miss, that was a really luxurious thing. We went, when I was a kid, we took the California Zephyr from Chicago to Oakland, and it was still, you know, they still had a dining car with white linen tablecloths and silver. And man, was that fun. Boy, that was really wonderful. How's the rain been? You know, we talked to Andy in Boston yesterday, and it was just drenching downpours.
I actually got a couple of tweets from people who were mentioning that you were talking to him. And, of course, he lives right down the street from me. So we had what I call biblical rainfall.
Yeah, no
and
kidding.
And we had hail and thunder and lightning. Our power stayed on, but our friend's house got hit by lightning, and their power went out.
Wow.
And they're not getting it back until tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness. You got to be careful, you know, if you have surge protectors, if you get hit by lightning, nothing can protect you against that. It just, you know, it fries everything. My friend Gina Smith got hit by, in fact, I was on the phone with her when it happened, got hit by her house, got hit by lightning, blew out all the kitchen appliances, blew out everything. The difference was if you have it on a surge protector, usually you have insurance and you can go to them and say, hey, fix it.
Yeah, we have a whole house surge protector, and of course all my computer stuff.
That's
is
a good
on
idea.
UPS, but my friends were telling me that when their house got hit, everything fell off the walls.
Oh,
the whole house shook,
So you're smart. I've heard of these whole house surge suppressors. Was that expensive to put in?
No, it was really cheap. We have an extensive electrical system in my house, as you might imagine, as I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, people like Vios came to work at the house and they looked at this thing and they said, geez, I've never seen anything like this outside of a business or whatever. But when we did that over, because we had to up the service when we moved in.
Right.
It only cost, I want to say, $150.
We should do that. I should do that at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody told me it's very inexpensive. An electrician could do it because it's kind of centered on where the electricity comes into the house. So it protects you, everything in the house. And I think that's a really good idea. I don't think they were very expensive either. Yeah. $100.
I don't think we've ever had any. We've had brownouts over the years here and there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's worth doing.
Nothing serious. Yeah. Haven't lost anything yet.
I'm glad you survived the biblical floods. I am glad.
I'll knock on the oak-flavored
Chardonnay. You got a little Chardonnay there? Oh, that's a Sangiovese.
It tastes better because it's illegal.
I don't want to know. Don't want to know. I guess you can't, you know, Massachusetts is one of those blue law states where you can't ship wine in, huh?
Sure.
That's weird. It's old-fashioned. It's because the nation's basically the nation's puritanical beliefs began in Massachusetts. That's where it
and
began.
Died in Massachusetts too. I'm sure. I think it's designed to protect the wine distributors, right? Which are I don't understand.
Well,
why we're protecting.
Maybe
Yeah, you know what? It all started when wine.com started. And everybody, all the wine distributors were terrified. You know, the brick and mortar wine distributors were terrified that everybody would start buying their wine online, which frankly doesn't make any sense. This is one product, like almost unlike any other, where you want to taste it, you want to try it, you want to get a sense of it. That's why people go to the wineries to buy it.
Sure. I would say that the few Massachusetts wineries that we have, you know, aren't worth worrying about per se.
It's not known
but
for
yeah,
its
you're
wine.
Right. I mean, we go to wine tasting events twice a year locally because you can taste the wine. How else would you buy wine? But
right, exactly.
I like the bottle.
Right. So you know? wine.com, I mean, I don't think it really ever took off. The only advantage is if you do have a wine you like from California at a small winery, they can sell it to you on their website. And maybe that does hurt the distributors a little bit. But, you know, who cares? Wine is good. Wine is good. We're in the wine country. I have to say that. I'm not a big wine drinker. I feel it's so wasted on me. It's so wasted on me. I feel bad. Here I am in the heart of the wine country. Hey, let's talk a little bit about Windows. You use a phrase that I like that I've only heard tech people use. Jumping the shark.
Oh, jumping the shark, yeah.
You say Randall Strauss jumps the shark. Before we say why he's jumped the shark, maybe we should explain what that means. Where does that come from, jumping the shark?
It comes from Happy Days.
Does it really?
Yes. Do you remember the famous episode where Fonzie jumped over the shark?
He jumps over a shark.
Well, okay, so you may remember one of the seasons ended with the Fonz jumping over whatever it was, cars or barrels, and then he crashes at the, or I think they froze it mid-frame, right? And then come back next season to see what happens. When you come back, he makes the jump and he crashed, and it was this big, you know, season finale.
Right.
So years down the road, of course, Happy Days, like many sitcoms, outwore its welcome. And there was a show where I think he was on, he's being pulled by a boat on skis and he jumped over a shark.
Right. And that was kind of the beginning of the end of Happy Days.
Oh, yeah. It's like the end of the end, as one might say. Happy Days, not to get off on a tangent, is one of those shows that I adored as a child. But now as an adult, I go back and I've watched it on DVD and it's horrible. You know, it's really bad. I feel.
Well, you grew up with it. It's not your fault. You were a kid.
Well, some shows I watched as a kid were great. Like the Planet of the Apes TV show. Fantastic. Probably from the same year, too.
Yeah.
But Happy Days.
Not such a hot shot.
But not so good. Anyway,
when you say jumping the shark, when you're saying you jump the shark.
Nice picture, by the way.
That's the Fonz. Jumping the shark. There you go. When you jump the shark, that means...
In a leather jacket, by the way.
Well, of course, he's the Fonz. Did he say A as he went over?
He had to have.
A! Shark!
I barely remember that. But anyway, the term comes from that, and it basically just means you've outworn your welcome.
You've gone...
We have arguably jumped the shark several times just today.
We do it all the time.
It's pretty much what we do.
So who is Randall Strauss?
Well, he's a columnist for the New York Times, and I have to say...
I read him. He's actually, I always thought, very smart because he's a business professor at San Jose State. He should know his stuff, right?
Okay. Yeah. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
I like Randall Strauss. I like his column. I've liked his writings. I saw this, you know, the headline on the Kindle on, I think it was Sunday morning, or the other morning anyway, whenever it appeared, and, you know, probably winced visibly. Because I thought, oh, here we go again. And this one's tough because, you know, there are people out there that I don't like, and I expect them to write crap like this. This one was unexpected and unwelcome. And it's one of those things where the further you get into it, the worse it gets.
Windows could use a rush of fresh air.
What this is, I just to put it simply, because this is something I could talk about forever. This is a regurgitation of that Gartner thing from, what, February?
We talked about it, yes.
Right, months ago we talked about this. I debunked it thoroughly on the Supersite, and he's just, it's like he just woke up to this, and he's just sort of rewriting it.
Right.
And presenting it, unfortunately, to a mainstream audience, which is, by the way, one of my big pet peeves. You know, people that write for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, whatever it is, national publications, I think I have a certain responsibility to be a little more fair to this kind of topic. You know, this isn't the place for, partisanry And this is painfully partisan. I mean, and not to mention horribly wrong.
He says, so, yeah, beginning as a thin veneer for older software code, Windows has become an obese monolith built on an ancient frame, adding features.
Right there. No, but stop right there.
Not true, you say.
Wrong. And by the way, I don't want to turn this into an episode of Don Imus, but I mean, we could literally just sit here and discuss this for hours.
Well, let's do it.
Let's take a little bit of it, because it would be stupid. I mean, I wrote a blog post. I really kind of tore this thing apart piece by piece. But let's look at just what you just said. One sentence.
Right.
First half of the sentence says, beginning as a thin veneer for older software code. Correct.
It was a shell in its earliest days.
Windows began as a shell for DOS.
Right.
Yep.
Absolutely. And was a DOS shell right through Windows 95.
Absolutely. Yeah. Through Windows 98 SE, let's say.
Okay.
Whatever. But here's the thing. Even that statement is wrong, because Windows today is not that thing. It is not descended from that thing. It's not the same software code. It does not have the same origins. There is nothing architecturally in today's Windows that's based on this thing that he just described. So
you're saying none of the code is the same.
What I'm saying is, none of the code that makes Windows is the same. In other words, there may be backwards compatibility stuff in Windows today for the purposes of running older software. But Windows, from an architectural perspective, the thing that makes Windows is NT, right? It's based on NT.
Right.
NT started as a project at Microsoft in the early 1990s. The first version was called Windows NT 3.1 because they wanted to line it up with Windows 3.1, which was the version of Windows at the time, the mainstream version of Windows at the time. Windows Vista, Windows XP, all of these NT-based versions of Windows share no code at an architectural level, right? No foundational code with this thing that he just described. So even this first sentence, even the
that's
first
wrong.
Half,
yeah.
Absolutely
wrong. All right. Let's take that out. Let's go on. Let's take that out. And let's say we'll start with NT351. Adding features. Plugging security holes.
No. Wait. We're not done with that first sentence.
There's more?
We've only touched on the first half.
Okay. Beginning as a thin veneer for older software code, it has It has become an obese monolith built on an ancient frame. Wrong. We just demolished that.
It's wrong. Well, it's wrong because the ancient frame he's describing,
it's not built on it.
It's not built on that. But actually.
Well, let's say it's 351. Isn't that an ancient frame?
That's right. That's what I wanted to get to. As this article goes on, what the comparison he tries to make is that operating systems such as OS X and Linux, in his words, lap Windows, because they're not built on ancient frames, on monolithic software code, on code that dates back decades, except for one thing.
They are.
Yeah, they do. In fact, they're built on code that vastly predates NT.
Yeah.
In fact, NT is based on the code for VMS. VMS was developed in the late 1980s, I want to say, whenever it was, in the 80s,
Unix was developed in 1969.
Right.
Yeah.
VMS was an attempt to respond to Unix.
Right.
It was an attempt to correct the problems with Unix.
Right.
So NT as the successor to that, the modern versions of Windows as the successor to that, are in fact responses to what's wrong with Unix. OS X and Linux are just Unix.
I might submit they're the wrong response, but okay, they're a response.
That's a completely different discussion.
It's a different discussion. You can't say it's that Linux and OS X are not based on an old code base, because they clearly are.
But there's a weird two-handed thing going on here, right? When it's Windows we're talking about, it's old, it's big, it's monolithic, it's obese, it's ancient.
Right.
But when it's Linux, OS X, Unix, it's elegant, it's small, it's fast, it's modern.
Well, even if you talk about Linux, it started in 1992. It's much older than Windows 95, 98, M8, and M3.5.1.
It's roughly as old as NT, let's put it that way.
Okay. Shall I go on?
By the way, Linux also, I mean, Linux as the project of a single individual in the early 1990s, not particularly sophisticated either, right? I mean,
yeah.
NT was very sophisticated right out the gate.
No, you're right. Written by people who had years of experience writing operating systems. They were the pros.
Absolutely. Before we get off into, again, a partisan debate about operating systems, I want to say, and I said this in my blog post, the point of my argument is not to turn the conversation around and make fun of OS X or Linux. I actually feel that Mac OS X and Linux are viable, modern, capable operating systems, just as is Vista.
Good, because I'd fight you if you said that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I feel like this whole comparison thing, you can talk about microkernels and monolithic.
But let's be honest. Let's come from an honest point of view, and let's not make stuff up.
Right. This stuff is crazy.
It's pain. Right. Okay, so adding
that's one sentence completely.
The first
wrong.
Sentence.
The problem is you start it with that, and then it's right. like now let's expand on it.
Right.
And it just gets worse and worse as far as it goes.
Adding features, plugging security holes, fixing bugs, fixing the fixes that never worked properly, all while maintaining compatibility with older software and hardware. Is there anything Windows doesn't try to do?
Okay, that's cute. So explain to me why adding features, plugging security holes, fixing bugs, and then fixing bugs that weren't fixed properly. Why is this bad? Is this what this thing's trying to do too much? Let's stop adding features. We'll do the other things, but we won't add new features. Then Windows would be okay to this guy. Is that really what we're saying? And are we really saying that that's not what the other operating systems do? I realize that in the case of Apple, they made that hard stop between, the classic Mac OS and the, free BSD based OS X, where they had that, massive changeover to a completely new architecture. Except that it was really only completely new for Apple. It was an existing architecture that Next had been working on for 10 years. It was based on work done at Mach and at FreeBSD for years and decades.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you want that. You don't want something that people haven't worked on and tried and fixed the bugs. And you don't want something that isn't compatible with hardware and software.
You and I have had these conversations lately around the notion that there are too many different versions of Windows serving too many different markets, and that maybe these things do need to be broken off into, say, separate consumer, business, and server.
Can I rewrite Randall's article? Removing deficiencies, I completely agree with you. What if we just said...
Why don't we just find a sentence that's correct? Let's do that.
Well, I can't.
Because it's got to be in there somewhere.
Worse.
There's got to be...
And by the way, what he's calling for here is a complete rewrite of Windows. Just start over from scratch.
Which is nothing new and is completely wrong. And for the reasons we discussed months ago, Microsoft has, in fact, completely re-architected Windows to be more componentized. They could create exactly what he's asking for, which is an extremely small and light version of Windows that doesn't have any of that extra application stuff on top of
it. Nobody would want it.
Right. There are marketing reasons not to do that. And the addition of applications like Movie Maker or Photo Gallery or whatever you want to talk about, it doesn't add to the
weight. That's not the operating system. That's just an application.
But it doesn't impact the running of the OS on an ongoing basis.
Because it's not the operating system,
The notion that anything could be bloated in a world where we have 1 terabyte hard drives, by the way, for like under $200 at Best Buy right now, we have 4 gigabyte RAM PCs. My computer has a 24-inch monitor. Why? Explain to me why I would want the most modern version of Windows to be cut down into something that no one would want to use.
Well, let me play devil's advocate. Maybe what he should have said is Windows, like every other operating system, after a while starts to show its age, and it's time to, instead of trying to...
Stop right there. With the first half of what you said is right. Windows, like every other operating system...
Starts to show its age.
Got it. Now, you respond to that in different ways, right? Apple responded to it. Now, I'm not talking Steve Jobs Apple. I mean Apple. Remember that for years they tried different things. They had the pink thing going on. They had the side stuff.
They were stuck with a crappy operating system that was really too old. System 7... had no modern memory management in it.
The version of Mac OS X that was available when Windows 95 shipped, you could actually still micromanage the amount of memory that individual applications received.
You had to. Remember? You had to because it had no memory manager in it.
This is right. So their
no automatic memory manager.
Yeah, their approach eventually was to shop around for something new. Remember, they looked at NT, they looked at Sun.
So I guess what they could have done is said, okay, let's graft a memory manager onto system 7, system 8, system 9,
and create a disaster.
Or let's throw the whole thing out
and
start over, either with an existing operating system, which they ended up doing Next, or writing our own, which they tried to do with Pink, which was a horrible failure. Copeland, I can't even remember what the code name was.
But you got to remember the situation at the time. Apple, as now in many ways, has a much smaller user base than does Windows, right? You can make these huge.
You could take these chances. That's exactly right.
Right. But the thing, now the other approach, the one that Microsoft
But wait a minute. Would it be? You see, Mike, what Microsoft seems to be trying to do is rebuild the airplane in the air.
Actually, no, no, hold on. Let's step back a second.
Okay.
I would argue that Microsoft did the changeover that Apple did, but did it more elegantly. They did it with NT.
I agree too. When they moved to XP, threw away that whole code base that was Windows 95, 98 ME, and started with NT.
The thing that they did different was they built compatibility right in. They built software compatibility right in.
I agree.
What Apple did was they provided temporarily
a
classic environment that you could run your apps within with various limitations and so forth.
Right.
And then it went away, right? It's not there anymore. Is it in Leopard? I don't even know.
It's gone. It's been gone for two.
That's what Apple did. All right, fine. That's fine for their market. It was fine for their market. What Microsoft did, I'm arguing, is fine for their market. Much bigger market, much wider range of customer types, much more applications you have to support, many more device drivers.
In fact, you might make the argument they did such a good job that people like Randall Strauss don't even know they did it. Can't even tell. Yep. They think it's the same version that Windows 3.1 was.
All right, play that wah, wah, wah song and let's move on, because this is the stupidest article ever written. This guy, I have lost all respect for this man.
So, okay, but I'm trying to salvage something, because I love him, and you're right.
I do too, I know.
This article is goofy. He jumped the shark. You're absolutely right.
Jumped the shark.
I guess I'm trying to salvage something here. Is there anything to be...
anything salvageable?
Is there anything to be said for the notion...
Yes.
That would it be a bad thing for Microsoft to say, you know, go off in a corner? You keep doing Windows NT based versions. Let's go off in a corner. Every company, every 10 to 15 years, technology changes so much that you need to start over. Don't you think? Would it be a bad thing for Microsoft to do that? They have the resources.
What you're saying, I think, in a way, that's what
Live Mesh may be.
Right. And that's maybe that's what Singularity is. Obviously, they have research projects based around things that may or may not turn up in the US. I guess what I'm saying is that from a theoretical standpoint, it's easy to say, well, all they have to do is start over. Oh, that's all they have to do. But except they have a billion customers.
Yeah, it's not that easy.
It's not that simple. And I really this is something I've wrestled with a lot over the last year because I've looked at this stuff. And, you know, I have to say that the ongoing componentization of Windows, starting with Windows Vista,
very
Server Core,
successful.
2008, the MinWin stuff.
Very successful.
This is very elegant because at the end of the day, you boot up Windows, you don't think anything of it. You have no idea that this has happened under the hood.
Hypervisor, all this stuff.
There's nothing new in Windows. Why? You know, this looks just like XP, except for one thing. Under the covers, it's completely different.
Yeah.
What an achievement that is.
Exactly.
He should be saluting them for this.
Yeah, it's in a measure of how well they've done it that people don't realize that they're in the process. No, I agree with you.
This kind of thing drives me crazy. You got to imagine me reading my Kindle at the table that morning.
Right.
And like, you know, I just want to.
No.
It's hard.
Randall Strauss jumped the shark. Yep. And there we go. I'll play the little just for you. He jumped the show. You can't hear it, but that was there. You know, I've got to play it one more time because it makes Paul happy.
You need to get the Fonz A sound in there.
Hey, hey. Yeah, no, I think you make an excellent point, and I think that frankly, New York Times readers deserve a better
and that's the problem. Like you said, this guy is an author, a professor of business.
I trust the stuff he writes. I've quoted him many, many times. Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
It just drives me crazy. I'm sorry.
No, you know,
I'm very sensitive to the notion of, like, you know, an individual attack on another writer. I mean, I've certainly gotten my share of this stuff over the years. I appreciate it.
You've been dissected just like this by John Gruber.
But it's often wrongheaded in that sort of a thing.
Of course, they're wrong.
I'm the type of personality that if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I don't know. I think it's cool to say I don't know. I think it's cool to say I'm wrong when I'm wrong.
Right,
it's fine.
Right.
This, I know what it's like to be attacked for pointless reasons. This one is hard because like I said, I'm going through this and I don't know that he's made a valid point anywhere in this article.
You do the same thing with Lee Gomes' article in the Journal. Now, by the way, Lee, longtime Silicon Valley reporter.
Sure.
He was at the San Jose Mercury News, another guy who was very highly respected. I think he's one of the best guys at the Journal, frankly, and knows more technology. He wrote an article that says, "Dear Windows 7 programmers, I have a few ideas." Right? Was that one?
Yeah, none of them are any good. Listen, There are many suggestions one could make. What's wrong?
I love it. No, I love that. That's you're absolutely. That's the way to handle it, Paul. Not Paul is not mealy mouthed in any way. When he believes something, he says it.
Okay. Now I feel bad about it.
No, so, don't. No, you're right. Well, let's take one. He says his number one thing. He thinks Windows 7. Yes. There should be one SKU. One SKU only. Right. There shouldn't be all these different versions. Now, Microsoft has reasonably been hit for having a lot of different versions of Windows Vista. But yeah, one only? That makes no sense.
Well. In fact, I would say, as the person who revealed the multi-SKU strategy for Windows Vista, I was, in fact, the first person to complain about it. Because the first thing I wrote about it was, there are way too many of these things. This is crazy.
But you can't just have one.
I don't think you can have just one. No. And we've talked about that. I think, at the very least, you need to have, on the client side, consumer and business.
And server.
And, by the way, and server, of course.
You need three, at least.
At least, yeah. Even Apple arguably has three, right? They have consumer or the...
Well, they have two. They have server and...
I would sort of say three, because but not in a bad way. I think Apple does one thing very, very wisely. They have the consumer or individual version, Mac OS X.
Right.
They have Mac OS X Server for servers, but they also have a family pack.
That's true.
And that's smart for this market, because lots of people have multiple computers.
Yeah.
And they're selling you a version that you can install on multiple computers. Why doesn't Microsoft do that?
Yeah. No,
that's
crazy. Yeah, I agree.
No one is going to pay full list price for Windows Vista three times. Silly.
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 All right. We won't go through this step by step, but if you want to look at Paul's demolishment
rant against
Lee Gomes.
Yeah.
You can see that also on the Super Site.
Destroying tech journalists one at a time.
You know, this is really, I think, one of the things I like about blogs is this is the opportunity for that you wouldn't see in mainstream media. You're never going to see, because it's too collegial. You're never going to see Lee write about Randall Strauss that way. Never see Randall write about Lee that way. And I think bloggers have both a ability and sometimes an obligation and duty to kind of call it as they see it.
Well, the Randall Strauss one, like I said, I read that at the table that morning.
Coffee all over.
I just ruined my Kindle. And then I very specifically didn't respond right away, because I knew if I wrote that right then, it would have been far more addictive than it turned out.
Right.
But then, of course, I go to write the thing and I can't even leave any of this out. It's all wrong. It starts off wrong and it just gets more wrong as it goes.
You've won me over.
At least I've beaten you into submission.
No. And I'll tell you the truth. It's the kind of thing you look at without thinking. You're reading it in the morning. You're just kind of going, I agree. You know, that's a good idea. Microsoft really should rewrite Windows.
They should rewrite Windows. That makes plenty of sense.
They're doing it.
Oh, jeez.
They're doing it all the time.
No, I know. This, no one gets it. I know. But then these are the same people complaining that Windows Vista wasn't different enough.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that funny?
Wah, wah, wah.
I'm coming to your side on Vista, by the way. The more I use it, especially since Service Pack 1, it's rock solid. I have had no problems with it. We're using it on a lot of different machines now, and it's been great. I'm using it for Skype. I'm using it for Stickam for the feed. We're using it to edit out there. I'm using it to record in here. It's been great. The only thing I don't like is that almost every program I launch on it turns off Aero.
Really? Oh, because you use crazy applications.
I'm using, older applications and stuff, and they turn off Aero. But then we found that Audition 3, the new Audition, was a little slow. It uses Aero, but it was a little slow. And when we turn off Aero, it was much faster. So there may be a reason why some of these heavy-duty recording programs don't want Aero running in the background.
Sure.
Makes sense, anyway. Hey, before we go on... Paul, let's take a break. We have another new sponsor we want to welcome to the Windows Weekly family, so to speak. GoToMeeting at GoToMeeting.com/WindowsWeekly. You know, I think I've told you about GoToMeeting before. I've certainly been talking about it a lot on the radio. Makes online meetings simple. Really sweet technology. Originally from Citrix, they do GoToMyPC. And GoToMeeting uses the same kind of technology to give you very fast, very effective online meetings. So what you do is you set it up on your computer, and then you can set up a meeting. You can use Outlook to do it. You just click a link. It'll send an invitation email, or you can go to the GoToMeeting site, set it up, get a meeting ID. There are a lot of different ways to do it. Very easy to do. Easy to do ahead of time. So you calendar it using Outlook. Or on the fly, you know, it could be on the phone with somebody saying, and saying, you know, I wish I could show you you know, these notes, or we could collaborate together, or I could do some training on this new application, or I'd love to show you a new application, or I'd love to show you a PowerPoint, whatever it is that you've got on your computer. What you do is you set up the meeting right there. You say, okay, go to gotomeeting.com. Here's the meeting ID. Your client or your colleague goes to gotomeeting.com, and they all of a sudden, you know, they give the ID, and all of a sudden they see your desktop right there on their computer screen. In full motion, they see the mouse move. You could show video. They get audio. You can show PowerPoint presentations, spreadsheets. You could even say, okay, well, you know, how about this for a paragraph? And they could say, well, no, let me edit that. And you could collaborate together on a document at the same time, work on it. Or you could say, okay, let me show you how to use the program. Now you try it, and they can take over control and do the same thing. You could even send the meeting to another colleague in another country. It's very powerful stuff, very fast, very effective. Routers don't get in the way, no configuration issues. It just works. You may have tried other online meeting technologies. If you have, you've probably said, this isn't for me. That's because you haven't tried GoToMeeting. Very affordable, one low flat monthly rate for as many meetings as you want, as long as you want. Very easy to use, goes right around firewalls, very efficient, and it's fun for your clients. It has to be fun. If they feel like it's no fun, well, that's no good. These make meetings more engaging. I want you to try it for free. Just go to gotomeeting.com/windowsweekly. You'll get 1 month unlimited online meetings, absolutely free. I think you're going to like it. Affordable, secure, effective. It's gotomeeting.com/windowsweekly. We thank them so much for their support of Windows Weekly. All right, let's move on. There are many more topics to cover. Microsoft Equipped, what is that?
So this is the subscription service they announced previously called Albany. And it's a combination of, Office 2007 Home and Student Edition with Windows Live OneCare, the security product. And then they also throw in the Windows Live Suite applications, which, of course, you can download for free anyway.
So it's a big package. And how much is it going to cost?
So it's a subscription service. I mean, you do buy the package, right? And you install it as you would application. You don't actually download it. It's $70 a year.
How much is the package?
How much is what?
The package.
Well, I think you probably pay $70 for the package, and then that covers the first year.
That's nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's not nothing. I mean, I would look at it this way.
I'd far prefer that than $350 for Office 2007.
Well, it's Home and Student Edition, right? So typically that costs about $125 to $140, right, dollars. Microsoft Equipped, I have a hard time with that word. It's like Equipped. I think I'm reading it in French.
Equipped. Equipped.
Yeah, I read Q U as K all the time. It drives me crazy.
But anyway, it doesn't have Outlook, which makes it useless for me. I don't understand.
Well, yeah.
I'd pay $100 a year if it had Outlook.
Yeah, sure. Sure. It could be installed in up to three PCs, right? So this is one of the few Microsoft products that has woken up to this. That's true of Office 2007 Home and Student Edition too, by the way.
Right. Right.
So when you think that thing is typically $125, maybe $140 at retail, and the typical time difference between Office versions is usually about 3 years.
It's expensive. You know,
I don't know. You know, it's not bad. Windows Live OneCare.
You're getting OneCare, which is what, $50 a year normally?
Yeah, retail. But that's the thing. I've seen it recently as low as free, by the way, with rebate. It's often available for under $20 a year. So.
I'll tell you I think this is the kind of thing a home user probably is going to buy. First of all, they don't think about it as being $210. They think of it as $70 a year, which is a lot easier to bite off. They also figure, well, if I don't use it, I don't have to pay for it next year.
It is a little weird. You've installed software on your computer,
right?
And a year goes by and now it no longer works.
We're used to that. You know why? Because of antiviruses. They all are subscription now, right?
Sure.
So, and many of them are $40 or $50 a year. So here I am, I'm getting OneCare, complete antivirus. And by the way, I think people say, hey, it's from Microsoft, it's going to work better. It has additional features like anti-spyware, keep your system running kind of features. And I get Office, which I need. I got to have.
Right. I think, and it also provides you with the free upgrade. So as long as your subscription is current and a new version of, say, Office ships, you get that for free.
I would do that if they maybe had a $30 more version with Outlook or something like that. Why don't they do that? I guess this is
well. I think what they're thinking is, as part of Windows Live, you get the web-based version of Windows Live Hotmail.
Oh, you don't need it, I guess.
And you might not need it. Yeah.
So it, because this is really the
this
home.
Really is the, I'm sorry.
This is a home package. Is the idea?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not for businesses.
Right, right. And they don't want to. They don't want to put in features that would make a business consider it even.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, arguably, Outlook is too much for the typical home user. It is a big application with a lot of stuff going on, much of which most people don't need. So, I agree with you that there should be a.
This is what Microsoft has wanted to do this for a while. Subscription software is very attractive to it. It's something businesses have been doing for some time. They've never been able to get the home user to do it. Home users, I don't know. There's some resistance to adding more bills. Sure. Oh man, I'm gonna get another. I got my cable bill. I got my ISP bill. I'm going to have my software bill. There's some resistance to that.
Welcome to the future. This is,
but I think it is the future. I think it's how it's going to be.
Look, diamond.
Yeah, you get your.
By the way,
I
forgot earlier. Part of this Windows Live suite, of course, is the Windows Live Mail client. There is actually a mail client included with that.
Yeah, there's mail and there's a calendar, right? Because that's one of the things you'd
have. There isn't a calendar yet. The Windows Live version of calendar isn't ready yet. So there's a beta up on the web and.
See, because that's
they'll be adding that. But Windows Vista comes with Windows Live Calendar.
Outlook Calendar. I use Outlook both as email, address book, and calendar, and I think they belong together somewhat, right?
We're in a weird time period right now where I'd have to say it's very obvious to me that Gmail is the way to go with email, but Google Calendar is excellent for calendaring. Google Gmail Contacts is horrible. It's completely unusable. And that makes this kind of messy, doesn't it? So if you go with the Microsoft route, I would say that Windows Live Hotmail or Hotmail with a live.com account, whatever that is, their contact system are both excellent. But they don't really have a calendar yet, unless you have Vista and then you have a local calendar. So you have sort of mail up in the cloud, but you have a calendar on the PC.
That's not so
PC.
Bad. I'd love to see syncing capabilities with all of this.
And obviously that's going to happen. So I think we're just at a weird point right now where you're right that Outlook is so far on the Windows side the one thing that does it all.
Is this the future for Microsoft? They're going to do a subscription based software all around.
Yeah, I mean they're doing this on the server as well. One thing they've previously announced they're going to talk about it more next week at their partner conference is what they call Microsoft Online Services, which is making really complicated and expensive servers like Exchange and SharePoint available to customers remotely hosted on Microsoft servers. With an uptime SLA and all that kind of stuff as a subscription cost, per month per user. And I really feel that that's the future for both home users and the businesses, right? Why, we talked about this, does IT matter? Why would people want to manage, maintain, deploy, work on upgrades and migrations, of these really expensive and complex technologies, not to mention the turnover you get naturally with people. And their training and their understanding of what is coming down the road and what they can afford to do and all that kind of stuff. Just have Microsoft host it.
let's do it. Do you think Microsoft
or
will
Google
do
it? Or whoever. It doesn't have to be Microsoft.
Does Microsoft want to do this with Windows at some point?
A subscription-based version of Windows, you mean?
Yeah. What if Windows... Well, of course, it's a little tougher because people get it for free right now, don't they? Nobody pays for Windows.
Sure.
So, yeah, that's a little harder.
It wouldn't surprise me to see them try to do that.
It'd have to be like $30. So you get it, and you get it's going to be tough.
I still think the Windows, I hate to use the phrase value proposition, but I think going forward, the deal with Windows is going to be Microsoft will position this as sort of the premium platform on which to do a lot of this cloud computing stuff.
Right.
Obviously, an application suite like Office 2007, even the home and student version, is vastly superior to anything that's available on the web. So it makes sense, for people to want this stuff. And, that runs on Windows. I realize it runs on the Mac too. But, they want to do certain integration pieces where, Windows becomes the logical or at least the best starting point for all of the other stuff you might be doing online.
Right, right. You hear that little rustling sound? You know what that is?
That's the sound of you not giving me a new... Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were
talking
about my microphone.
Patience. I will give you a new microphone. No, it's the sound of people leaving the line at the AT&T stores all over the country.
Leaving the line.
Getting out of line for the iPhone. I have to say, I have talked to a lot of people once AT&T announced their pricing on the iPhone who said, oh,
they left.
I'm not buying that.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it? Talk to me. What do you mean?
It's expensive.
Yeah, but we already knew it was expensive.
Yeah, but it's more expensive than we knew it would be.
I think it's exactly as expensive as we knew it would be. What do you mean?
Well,
I don't think anything happened this week to, I mean, obviously AT&T released their pricing, but it's what I thought it was. I think it is what we thought it was going to be.
I guess. I mean, it's expensive.
It's expensive.
It's expensive. Yeah. And SMS is expensive. And they're going to charge me $18 to change from my old iPhone to my new iPhone. Huh?
18? Is that what it is?
Yeah. $36 if you have to activate a new one.
I'm surprised that you know that because I've been trying to get into that AT&T website to find out.
Oh, you got to watch the Todd video.
Oh, it's insane to me that they released this information and said, go here to see if you qualify. And then you go and it says, hey, sorry, we're down for system maintenance. And it's been like that ever since they announced it. I just checked it before the show.
Oh, that's just absurd.
Oh, AT&T drives me insane.
The worst.
I think it's important that AT&T will always be the Achilles heel of the iPhone. And this just makes it even more, even more true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Apple's worst partner in history. So is this the site? It looks like this is the site that you're talking about. And it looks like it's...
Does it work?
Well, it's working on my system. The iPhone 3G site? Right, see if it works on
yours.
Yeah,
so go down to the bottom. No, that site works.
Oh, you're saying there's more at the bottom.
Yeah, let me see if I can find it. Let me see.
iPhone for business, where to buy, eligible for an upgrade, get ready.
Eligible for the upgrade. Look on that link.
Log on to your My Wireless account. Have an account with them. So, I mean, I do, but I don't. Actually,
I'm
going to
try it right now. This thing has been down for maintenance ever since they made this announcement.
So this is where you log in to see your account and see if you're eligible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I can't. why would they make this information available and then...
You know, I found that actually to be true with most cell phone companies that the, oddly enough, that the mytmobile.com, is it working?
No, I hate this company. We apologize for the inconvenience, but we are currently conducting system maintenance that prevents us from retrieving your account information.
Yeah, I
see
that all the
time. Please try to log in again at a later time.
I see that all the time, but it's not just AT&T, every cell phone company, every company I have an account with.
They just made this announcement. Here it is. Here's the info. Click on here.
Go here. Go here. Find out more. If you can get in.
Just kidding.
If you can get
it. AT&T, jump the shark.
I'm just not. I'm not. I was kind of hoping that this would be the I have an iPhone. I gave it to Dane, though.
Hold on. I will say this.
Yeah.
I already knew this was going to be really expensive.
Didn't shock you. No sticker shock.
No, people talk about the costs. Like, in other words, AT&T will say, in the old version, I think it was $69.99 a month was the smallest package you could buy.
Right.
And so people would say, okay, it's $69.99 a month. Except that's not what it is a month because they tack all these fees and stuff on top of it. And it's actually about $15 more than that.
Right.
So the actual real world cost, if you have the smallest plan of every kind possible, including SMS, is going to be over $90 a month. That's as cheap as it gets in the U.S. That's expensive.
Although we can't complain because we don't have any data limits like they do in Canada. I mean, the cheapest plan they've got, only get 400 megabits.
That's a completely different story. Yeah. I will say this in AT&T's defense, and this is the last time you'll ever hear me say anything nice about it.
Wow. That's a phrase I never expected to hear out of your mouth.
You may recall that when this iPhone 3G first came out, one of the big things, and I and others complained about this, was that if you look at AT&T's coverage map, their 3G network is in approximately 1% of the country.
Right.
Really, really small coverage. Right. Actually, you need to go back and look at it again because they just updated it. And whereas I was completely not covered by this before where I live, now I am inside of a huge 3G zone.
Oh, that's good. And
they've updated that. So assuming that's correct, it looks like the countrywide coverage in the United States is going to be much better than we previously thought.
So what you have to do is go to the AT&T coverage viewer, and then you'll see view 3G mobile broadband coverage in select areas.
Yeah, and you can zoom
areas.
In and out. And, yeah.
Well, no, that's not a map, though. That's just a list.
No, there is a map. I don't remember. I don't have the URL for it, but I looked at it the other day. Let me see if I can find it.
Well, see, on my system, there's view coverage. Let's see. Is this a map? Oh, yeah. No, see, I think you're confusing.
No, I'm not.
I think you're confusing regular coverage. So
No, you can turn it on. You have to click. There's a box that says turn on 3G data coverage.
Okay.
It's like orange and blue. The blue is so
I'm
regular.
I'm just looking at the list in select areas.
Listen, I would not make this up. I hate AT&T.
I don't get it in my town. I can tell you I'm not on the list. So you're saying Dedham is? Because I only see Boston, Cambridge, yeah.
Actually, no,
Hyannis,
it's AT&T, Lowell. So parts of Dedham are. That's what's funny about it. If you go down the street a couple blocks, there's a huge hole. But most of the town that I live in, yes, is in fact covered.
All right.
Now, it wasn't before. We were completely outside of it before.
Right.
According to their old map.
Oh, I see the checkbox here. Show 3G coverage.
Yeah.
In select areas. That turns it blue if you show 3G coverage.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Trust me, I would never make.
I guess the real proof will be in the pudding. I mean, this is just a map. Let's see what happens when you get home your iPhone.
And yeah. Matt, listen, anyone can draw a picture of the United States.
Anyone can draw a map.
That's right. That's right.
I'd like to.
I don't
see
trust
it.
AT&T.
I don't trust them. I'd like to see it. Well, if you don't trust your websites that you're visiting, you might want to take a look at the new security features in IE8. Wow.
Once
you like
again,
that?
Sir. Excellent.
IE8, they've announced a security preview. I mean, they've announced a beta 2, right?
Well, what they've done is announced the security features that will be in IE8, and the first time you'll see most of them
will be in beta 2.
Will be in beta 2. That's coming out next.
Yeah. But that's
some
next
of them are actually in beta 1.
Okay. So what are we going to see? Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's nothing too dramatic or inobvious. You know, there isn't some magic bullet type of thing, but you know, in beta 1, they had that domain highlighting, which I didn't quite get. But one of the things that they do that I think is a really good idea is that if you're on a website that's supposed to be an SSL type site or a site where you're going to put your credit card information in, mm-hmm. and it redirects you to an IP address, it will color that address bar red because that's the sign that, you know, something has gone horribly wrong, which I think is neat.
Right.
They've got they're replacing the phishing filter from IE7 with something called the smart screen filter. And the smart screen filter actually works exactly the same way that Firefox 3 does, right? It colors the browser window red when you go to a site that's known to be bad. It's on a blacklist of sites that are known to deliver malware. It's exactly the same.
Does that phishing filter, does that slow things down a little bit?
I hope so, Leo. I really do.
Why? Are you a fisher?
No, I'm just kidding.
I haven't noticed. I turn it off. I just turn it off. I figure I know I'm not going to get fished. But of course, that's the first person.
So I don't know. I don't know the way it's implemented. I would guess. I think it does this on Firefox. Is the way that they do it is they periodically update a local version of a list of the browser. So if that's the case, it shouldn't be that slow.
If it's local,
obviously,
yeah.
if you're hitting a server every time, it would be dramatically slower. So I can't imagine they're doing it that way.
Then there also is a filter on what you download, right?
Yeah, so they're also they provide information in the download window. So if it's coming from a site that's known or at least not known to be bad, you have that sort of green checkbox, and they'll actually block downloads from sites that are, you know, potentially bad, you know, or known to be bad. There's a bunch of ActiveX stuff. You know, they've put a lot of limits on ActiveX. I think some people would ask why don't they, you know, just get rid of ActiveX.
No, I don't think so. I think ActiveX is very useful, and I think that IE7's handled it really well, which is it just doesn't do it unless you every single time give explicit permission to do it. You get that yellow line at the top of the window. I think that's a very good way to do it.
They're building on that. You know, they're doing such things as for non-widely distributed ActiveX controls, things like Adobe Flash, QuickTime, Windows Media Player, they'll only be installed per site and per user. So if you have multiple users on a PC, that ActiveX control will only be installed
for
the user that installed it and will only work on the site from which you installed it.
That's good,
and
too.
It prevents hackers from taking advantage of vulnerabilities in particular controls and redirecting things.
No,
and
I like that.
So smart. But one of the other ones I think it's kind of big is they've added data execution prevention support to IE8.
Good.
And this is a feature. It's in XP and it's in Vista. But in those operating systems, it works with everything except for Internet Explorer because they know there are these compatibility issues with certain ActiveX controls, and they weren't able to overcome that. So DEP is actually turned off is not enabled, for Internet Explorer. But if you have Vista SP1 or XP SP3 and you install IE8, you'll actually get data execution prevention in Internet Explorer 8, and that will provide you with the buffer overflow protection capabilities, you know, the type of, they overflow the memory and they try to inject code into a different process, that kind of thing. So
I think that's great.
Yeah.
DEP is a really good tool, and the more places it works, the better. When are we going to see IE8? I mean, this is beta 2 will be out next month. Are they pretty close?
Yep. You know, I'm not sure. You know, I had a briefing with these guys, and there's a lot more coming in beta 2 than just this, right? There'll be a lot of consumer-oriented end-user features. There'll be presumably some user interface work and so forth. I don't know if this is going to be a beta 3 or if we go straight to release candidate after that. I'm not really sure. But I would say, off the top of my head, probably by the end of the year at the very earliest, possibly early next year, yeah.
I've been very impressed with what Microsoft has done, because IE6 really was dangerous. And, you know, we just spent a lot of time telling people to use Firefox. IE7, out of the box is great. Sure. And when you run it with Vista and you turn on the browser protection, I think you're very, very secure. I think they've done an excellent job.
I will say this about IE. You know, on the MacBook that I bought recently, where I'm running Vista on there, for some reason I've noticed lately that Firefox has some issues where it actually causes the system to pause. And it's only on this laptop. I don't know why, but you will run the thing and all of a sudden, you know, the mouse doesn't do anything. The page won't refresh. It won't move in any way. You can do stuff outside of that window.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like it stops working.
It's thinking.
I don't know what it's doing. It's
it happens to me a lot on Macs, to be honest with you. It seems to be a common Mac problem.
It's the type of thing that I sort of associate with low memory computers, slow processors, that kind of thing. It's very strange. Only affects Firefox. I don't know why yet. If I run Internet Explorer, which I don't typically do, frankly, except for some work.
Again, this is on Windows on the Mac.
Yeah. And it's only on this machine. I don't know. Huh. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Well, I've stopped saying to people, you've got to have Firefox. I generally say if you're using IE7, especially if you're using it on a Vista, you're just as secure. So use Firefox for the extensions if you want the extensions.
I think Firefox is good for that kind of thing. If you're into customizing, if you have specific needs.
Right.
But for the first time, this is one of those things you don't have to do.
That's great.
IE6 was dangerous. You had to get rid of it.
You had to, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is the way they're handling ActiveX now and things like that. So that's good.
Right. Protected mode on Vista and so forth. It's great.
So did you shed a tear on Bill Gates' retirement day on last Friday?
Did he retire? I didn't even notice.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, that's the real question is, any changes in Microsoft in the last few days you've noticed? Anything different?
Nothing positive. I think Jay Allard got more control over the entertainment division, which I don't like.
Right.
Yeah, nothing yet.
It's not, you know, it's not going to change that much. And of course, and I got a lot of calls about this, and I want to clarify on this. June 30th was the last day XP was sold in stores.
Sure.
It looked like Microsoft was saying OEM copies weren't going to be sold anymore either, but you could still get XP from...
You could still get it.
And okay.
You could even get XP in retail stores today if they were still there. It's sort of a while supplies last kind of thing.
Okay.
It's not like they took them all back and said, you know, we're not doing this anymore.
Not going to make anymore. But you could. But Lenovo will still sell you a laptop with XP.
Any PC maker can legally downgrade you. Yeah, anyway.
Okay. And that'll go on for how long will that go on for?
That can go on forever. It's supported through 2000. It's supported through the day you and I die, as far as I can tell.
Well, we know
XP will outlive all of us.
We know through 2014, Microsoft said we're going to continue to support it. So,
yeah,
quite some time. Yeah, I got calls from radio stations saying it's the end of the line for XP, and I say no, it's not.
Not exactly.
No.
Not exactly.
No,
I think what's really going to happen is that demand for XP will fall off this year, and then finally next year. And I think the realistic answer to that is, you know, Dell, Lenovo, those guys. Eventually, people will just stop wanting it, except for maybe their business customers for a few more years.
Yeah, and that's why Microsoft's doing it. A business, and it's completely understandable. A business doesn't want to retrain, and I know you say, well, it's not that different, but even the slightest difference, you got to teach your employees, no, that's now how you do it. It doesn't say start anymore. You know, you got
sure.
That business doesn't want to do that. They have to test it. I mean, it's easy to stay with the same operating system, so that's why businesses do that, but it doesn't mean it's not. I guess that's the big thing that I would say. I think Vista's great. I love Vista, but is it an improvement? Is it enough of an improvement to stimulate people to leave XP? And I'd say in that case, I don't think people see such a difference that they say, well, I got to go to XP. I mean, I think it's much more secure. I mean, that's very apparent now.
Yeah, that would be the big thing. It would be security.
Yeah, but that's invisible, right? You don't see that.
Yeah, it should be. You're right. I mean, that's the goal. Although I have to say, I mean, I don't typically have security problems, obviously.
Right.
But I'm alarmed at how often my friends have to email me to tell me that they've gotten whatever they've gotten. And I'm starting to push
people on the radio show, because that's the least sophisticated users I talk to, toward Vista. because I really I think that they're the ones who need to be running Vista.
Yeah, and that falls into the whole IE7 thing, right? The idea is that people aren't going to do anything anyway, so at least this system is more secure by default.
Right, right.
You know?
Right,
so they'll be more protected out of the box.
Yeah. Finally, talking about security, Firefox users the most secure on the internet?
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Which is interesting because, you know, and if you actually read about that study, it's not because they're using Firefox, right? It's because they're the type of people that would install.
They're proactive.
Firefox.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
like
exactly
that.
What you say. It's the people we have to worry about are the people who just open the box. It's the same with a router. They plug in the router.
It's the
works,
people who
done.
Have a router with a wireless network named Linksys. Those people need to be booted right off the internet.
Exactly. Well, no, they need to be educated. No, Paul, they need to be educated.
We have an island off of California.
They need to be educated. That's why I do the radio show. And I'm very
like
gentle
really
with
movie.
Them.
It's like a prison colony. They
yeah,
can do
yeah,
or
yeah. Papillon. I got spyware and they sent me to the island.
Exactly.
It also said that
that's what I'm talking about.
Firefox users were far and away the most likely to use the latest version, 83%.
Yeah.
Running the latest browser.
I don't understand how you could run software and not have the latest version. Of course, I'm.
Well, that's the thing. We are different people. And everybody who listens to this show and everybody who watches Twit, that's a different group of people. Though we are not normal. And we might as well start realizing that.
One of the reasons I switched my wife to the Mac a few years back was I used to go upstairs to her computer and there would be all these dialogues all over the desktop about upgrading to this, doing this. And she never clicked on any of it.
No.
And I said, I don't understand.
That's normal.
Yeah.
That's,
why can't you just do this?
No. She's normal. We're the weirdos. Sure. My wife's the same way. My wife doesn't even close Windows.
Right. Close
applications.
No, my wife doesn't either. That drives me crazy.
Yeah. She's got
every application on earth is running in the tray and none of them have anything open.
She doesn't close them.
None of them doing anything.
That's normal. It's not necessarily correct, but
it's not what
normal.
We call best practices.
No. But it's how people are.
Sure.
And I think unfortunately a lot of, you know, we more sophisticated users often have very little tolerance for everybody else.
Yeah. Oh, no. But on the flip side, I also think this came up this morning via Twitter. You know, the Twirl application came up with an update. So I immediately clicked on it and upgraded.
Right away. Immediately.
I didn't even look to see what it did. I just did it.
I love updates. I saw you say that. That was very funny.
I love that stuff. So I think I have a problem on the flip side of this, right? You know, so I even get into the situation where I've been running Windows Vista now for a while. It's kind of boring because there's nothing going wrong. And I need a beta. I need a beta something.
He's jonesing.
I need something to completely screw it up.
That's really true. I think that's how power users operate, and that is not really necessarily a good thing.
It's not healthy.
It isn't.
That's what I'm saying.
It isn't. You're absolutely right. Rhapsody, what do you think about that going DRM free?
Yeah.
I wish their subscription service were, but I guess you can't with a subscription.
Of course,
service.
If it was, I would join it and download every album on
and then quit. But. Right.
Yeah. Well, actually, so the fact that it's subscription service is not DRM free is not the problem. The problem is that the subscription service doesn't work, of course, with the iPod.
Right.
So I think what they've done is smart and necessary. They do have a big library. I think they said they had 5 million songs, if I remember correctly. Huge library. But, we already have Amazon for this kind of thing. I know Napster is MP3 as well. I think it's notable in this day and age that as all these companies are going MP3 with no DRM, that, you know, Apple can't do this, right? Because apparently the record companies aren't giving this capability to Apple.
This is really kind of, I think, the subtext of what's going on is that the record companies are trying to kill iTunes, which is now the number one store of all.
That's quite a strategy. You know, it's like, let's pick our number one partner and just try to screw them over.
Yeah. But, you know, the record companies are really masters of finding bad strategies.
I was going to say, this is not the first time they've acted.
They're amazing.
Yeah,
so what they're trying to do is they feel iTunes has too much power. So, we'll get rid of DRM for everybody except Apple. So you've got Amazon, you've got Napster, you've got Rhapsody, all with unprotected music. And they're hoping everybody will go there. But it's probably good for us. What they're trying to do is create competition.
Right. So what? Right. But all they're really doing is they're forcing me in some ways to shop somewhere else. You know, I want MP3 files.
Right.
Unprotected MP3s. I don't care where I get them. Yeah.
I've been buying on Amazon. I love Amazon.
Yep.
And it's more like buying a record. You know, it feels like that to me more.
They also have this nice deal at Amazon where if they don't have what you want in MP3, you can buy the CD. And of course, because it's Amazon, they have used stores and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes you have a choice. You can buy the digital album for $10. You can buy the real CD for $12, or they have the used versions from a variety of merchants for as low as 99 cents or something.
Exactly.
You know, so, to you. That's good stuff.
Good stuff. I agree. All right. We're going to take a break and come back with your tip of the week, your software of the week as well. Couple of good ones here. But before we do that, it's time for our Audible recommendation of the week. Our show is brought to you, as most of the network is, by audible.com, the great resource for audiobooks. We're big Audible fans. AUDIBLE.com. 50,000 titles and growing fast. Now that they're owned by Amazon, you're going to see, I think, some real growth. They're actually starting to make deals with publishers to record books for them. I'm just thrilled. We are in the golden age of audio books, and it's thanks to this company, audible.com. If you're not yet a member, go to audible.com/windows and just sign up. You'll get a credit toward a free book, but also just browse around and see all the stuff they have, not just books, radio shows, lectures, all kinds of audio content, podcasts. What's your book of the week?
So did you see the thing I sent?
Yeah, I like this. You know what's so funny?
This
was the book of the week on MacBreak Weekly, too.
Oh, are you serious?
Great minds think alike.
Having never listened to this show that you mentioned, I did not know that.
What is this Macintosh of which you speak?
Are they still around? That's cute.
Yeah, okay. They're cute. The cute computer.
Yeah. Cute Mac users.
Cute. They're so cute.
No, it's called, I was sort of afraid at first that this might be a little too controversial.
But I don't think it is. It's funny.
And this is one of the funny.
It's about us.
By the way, I have to say, it is about us, and that's what makes it funny, I guess. The joke is on us, as we say.
Yeah.
It's called Stuff White People Like, The Definitive Guide to the Unique Taste of Millions by Christian Lander.
It's actually, it started as a website.
You should play, you do have the site up, you should play the little clip they have.
I shall.
It's hilarious. It's all the stuff that we have sort of talked about, you know, traveling and wine and, you know, coffee and stuff. And of course, you know, it's mocking.
It's so sad, it's really. It's so pathetic, Paul. Here's a little clip from. And by the way, I think if you read this, you should read it like this. It should be like Thurston Howell the Third.
Exactly. That's what it is, right? Like this, some country club.
Yes. Yeah. Let's see what. Let's see what stuff white people like, shall we? Let's
white
find
globe
out.
Trotter. Instructions. Fill in and have fun. Hey everyone, sorry for the mass email, but I only have a short period of time at the Internet Cafe here in fill-in-foreign country. The flight from fill-in-city took forever, and I was seated next to this really gross person from fill-in-country who wouldn't shut up. I swear, next time I fly to fill-in-foreign country, I'm flying first class. So when I got to the airport, I picked up my backpack and went through customs. I don't care what anyone tells you, it's really not that bad unless you are carrying fill-in drug. Speaking of which, I met this crazy fill-in nationality dude at the hostel who said he can get that for fill-in dollar amount an ounce. Can you believe that? So one day, I went on a tour of the city to visit all sorts of fill-in religious buildings. It was amazing. I have never felt so spiritual. I took a lot of pictures on my fill-in camera brand and model. When I get back home, I am totally going to convert to fill-in religion or food lifestyle.
Oh, this is too close to home, Paul.
It's bad. They have so there's a line on the page that says, white people love nothing better than sipping free trade gourmet coffee, leafing through the Sunday New York Times, and listening to NPR.
Oh, see.
Oh boy.
They should mention podcasts in there somewhere.
They do actually. Apple products, indie music, food co-ops, vintage t-shirts, by the way, you can see on
there. Yeah, I like that one. That's what is that? A boombox on your t-shirt?
A boombox, because I'm old school. They believe they're unique, and yet somehow they're all exactly the same.
You don't need a boombox to listen. You can play on any MP3 player. In fact, good news, the Zune coming soon, right, Paul? You told me that. And any minute
Zune.
Now, the Zune,
Zune.
Coming Zune, also the Kindle,
Audible,
Kindle, all the iPods, You know, I found out when I was in New Jersey that one of the big categories after the iPods is GPSs. Garmin Nuvi is one of their big players. Makes sense. You put it on a little chip. You put it in your Nuvi.
Sure.
After you found where you're going or you're not using the GPS, you can listen to a book. It's got a little speaker on it. Audible. Love it. Audible.com/Windows. We thank them for their support of Windows Weekly. I just love books.
Just mocking ourselves.
Yeah. Well, we deserve it.
I think so, too.
We deserve it. Christian Lander wrote that.
We did spend the first 10 minutes of a Windows podcast talking about wine, after all.
And after that, ripping apart the New York Times.
Exactly.
They got it wrong again, Pauly. We need white people nicknames. I'm going to call
Biff and
yeah,
that kind of thing.
I actually went to school with a guy named Dink.
Oh, man.
And he was a Morgan.
That's great.
He was a Morgan. Dink Morgan of the J.P. Morgan line. Hi, Dink. Hey, Buffy. Ready for some tennis, Buffy? Sure, Dink. It was actually just like that.
That's good stuff.
Now, let's get on to your tip of the day.
I, however, grew up in Dedham. We don't have people like that.
No, you have a different kind of white people. We call them swamp Yankees.
Swamp Yankees.
Yeah, swamp Yankees. So what is your tip of the day? Did this come in from a reader or?
So he presented me with Dan did via email, a sample tip, which was about removing individual file type associations.
Okay.
So for example, you know, when you install applications, they'll seize a bunch of file associations.
Yes. That's less of a Windows problem than it. That used to be a massive problem, didn't it? Has it gotten better?
Yeah, it has gotten a little bit better. But as anyone, for example, an iTunes user will be able to commiserate over this problem. You know, you launch iTunes and it will always pop up this thing. It says some of our file associations have been taken by another program. Right. By the way, often the other program is QuickTime, but that's another story.
Really?
And
that's funny.
Would you like to fix this? And you say, yeah, I would like to fix that. So when you do that, it brings up in Vista, it brings up this thing called default applications, default programs, which is one of the most horrible bits of user interface that's ever been created in the history of Microsoft. What I've found is this. It's actually much easier to just change file associations on the fly. So the tip that he provided was actually a way to do it via the command prompt. I'll put it up on the blog so you can see it and you can play with it. It does work, but it works to remove file associations. And the theory there is that when you remove a file association, and then you double-click on that document type or that file type, it will then ask you what you'd like to open it with. But actually, I think there's a better way of doing that. And this is something I actually do all the time. So what you do is you hold down the shift key, and then you right-click on a document or a file, and then you choose open with instead of open. And when you do that, a little menu will pop out on the side. It will list the known application types that can open that document type. Or you can choose the last option, which is choose default program. And when you do that, you actually get a very simple open with dialog box. So you can, from here, you can do one of two things. You can pick an application if it's in the list of recommended programs. So for example, like a doc file, you might choose Microsoft Word. There's a checkbox at the bottom that says always use the selected program to open this type of file. And if you leave that selected, obviously from then on, that application will be associated with the file type. But you can also browse from there, and you can select an application from the program files directory. So if the application you want to use isn't there, you can go find it. But you can also leave that always use the selected program option unchecked. So maybe this time you just want to use, you know, whatever application just for this one time. So it's also a handy way just to open files with a different application just one time, you know, which may be the case.
I like that because I like the kind of refined control you can get.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting about this is if you do have to browse for an application and you find it, you know, using this interface, the next time you use Open With, that application will also appear in the recommended programs list. So you only have to do that one time.
Very good. That's a very handy tip. So Dan thought that up?
Well, he found he found something I had frankly never heard of. It's a command line.
Oh, you can do this from the command line.
It's a crazy thing that you do from the key. I'll document it on the blog by the weekend so people can see it. But I just think this is a little simpler and maybe more applicable.
But very handy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the open, we'll use the open with, but if you want the command line, you can look in the show notes and we'll have that there. Or on Paul's blog, the super site for Windows.
Yes, sir.
And you have a couple of programs of the week this week.
Yes. Actually, both are email recommendations for whatever that's worth. One of them, a reader had written in and said, I'm moving all my stuff off of one PC and I'm moving it to another PC. And I have ways to back up documents and I can move my mail and all this other stuff. But I have all this wireless network configuration stuff for work and for home and for different locations outside of the house. I'd like to back up that information somewhere. How do you do that? I thought, you know, that's interesting. I don't know of any easy way to do that other than some command line stuff again, which is horrible. So I did a search and I found something called the Wireless Migrator. And that's exactly what it does. It backs up and restores wireless profiles. And it's at codeplex.com/WLAN. And yeah, what a great idea. You know, there is actually no way in the Windows UI to do this other than through some really complex command line stuff. And this is basically just a front end for that.
I used to use a program before Wi-Fi. This is a long time ago that would remember network profiles, but and then would many times allow you to change the profile without rebooting Windows. Because that was always kind of a pain. Does this require a reboot?
No. This is, well, the way Windows works today is you can have different profiles and it will adapt on the fly. And obviously with wireless networks, that's a very common thing to do. So, and in Vista, you know, it also remembers with each profile whether or not that's a public or private network and so forth. So that stuff's just built into Windows. This is for when you've already configured your wireless networks on one computer.
Oh, you want to move it around.
You want to move them around to a different computer, yeah.
Doesn't Windows do that? Because I know sometimes it'll say, well, do you have a USB key with the configuration
you'd like? Yeah, there's some wizards in there for like wireless network setup. And this is just for anything that's in the network, anything in networking will
take
it up.
The entire thing, yeah. I like that because I do that all the time. I'll set up multiple machines at once. And you have another program called Digsby. It's very cute.
Yeah, now have you seen this or used this?
No, tell me about it.
You know, it's funny. I've tried this in a few different ways because when I first started using Twitter, I was trying to find an application for posting and viewing tweets and so forth. And I settled on Twirl, which I like. Although, again, because Twitter is such a lousy network infrastructure, Twirl breaks
all the time. Yeah,
yeah, it often doesn't work. Digsby is really interesting because it combines. A bunch of different support for a bunch of different IM networks, including Windows Live Messenger, which I do use, with a bunch of social networking type services, including Twitter and things like MySpace and Facebook and so forth. And if you want it to, for some reason, you can also use this thing to get email notifications. So it's sort of like an all-in-one communications tool.
I like it.
By default, you can actually change the UI in very meaningful ways, but by default, it has a very Spartan, I would call it Google Talk type UI, which I actually kind of like. And I can't remember anymore. You know, when I first tried it out, I ended up going back to Twirl, and I can't actually remember why. So I'm going to give this one another shot, but I've gotten so much email about it. I think we must have talked about this when I was out there last week.
Digsby.
The need for an integrated client. So I got a bunch of email about this. So
yeah, neat.
I actually already had it installed. I just had stopped using it. So
that's
I'm going to give this one a shot.
Yeah, and I've used Pigeon and I've used Trillion. Of course, I love Trillion. But they're IM only. This looks like it does IM and, which is kind of
nice. IM and a bunch of other stuff. Yeah.
Well, I will take a look because I'm a Twirl guy. And you were on Twitter as Thurot. We mentioned Twitter a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So if people want to follow you, it's just your last name, Thurrott. And they can follow your Twitters and your tweets. Do you find you're still Twittering as much as you used to?
Yeah. It, you know, obviously goes up and down, as does everything else in life, depending on what's going on. I have these sort of devious thoughts every once in a while where I construct what I consider to be like the perfect Twitter tweet, you know, and depending on what it is, sometimes
it's fun, isn't
well it? Received, and sometimes it isn't. But you know, they're not all home runs. That's all I'm saying.
This is the original concept behind Twitter was that it was a microblogging platform, and so you're writing a blog post, but you only have 140 characters, and there's a real challenge to getting you know, just right in 140 characters. I enjoy it. I'll write it big. And then I'll trim and edit until I can get it down into that 140 characters, you know?
Right. So I look at Twitter as, you know, actually, and by the way, this is a fairly recent development. I sort of looked at Twitter originally as this would be another place where I can sort of put stuff out there.
Spam. You know? Personality and, spam.
Well, yeah. No, not spam, but yeah. You know,
links.
Whatever. Things, whatever. Yeah,
stuff I'm doing.
So I wasn't on there very long, and somebody wrote back and said, you know, for this thing to work properly, you need to follow other people too.
Right.
Right? You can't just be a
two-way street.
Standing up on a rock. Yeah. And that, you know, that's an interesting point. So I now follow a bunch of people, and what this has turned into is what I like to do so much, either via the website, like I feel like we do here, where it's sort of a conversation with people that are out there. So I've even changed my contact page on the super site to say, hey, look, I would really prefer to have these conversations via Twitter, because then they can benefit other people.
Right.
Right. Because unfortunately, and this happens every day still, I get an email, I answer a question, sometimes in depth, and then it's gone. And one person benefited, and they're usually very appreciative, but you know, that was the end of it. And I don't ever think to publish that stuff to the blog, but maybe I should.
Right.
But
right.
I feel like this is more interactive. And if people want to reach me, it's on I leave it open all day long. I interact with it all day long. You know, if I'm here, obviously. And I occasionally interact with it from the phone. I have that, was it Halo or Halo application on the iPhone. So I can send them.
Oh, Halo. Yeah.
No, I
think you're absolutely right. I think you get a lot more out of Twitter. You know, you probably might want to start looking at FriendFeed also.
Yeah.
FriendFeed is a real
I'm on FriendFeed too.
Yeah, it's much more of a conversation. Well, Twitter is a conversation, but it's a hard conversation to follow.
Yeah. So I think that applications like Twirl make it a little better.
Yes. It's easier to see your app replies, yeah.
Yeah, I like that kind of stuff. And I do use FriendFeed, although I'd say for right now, FriendFeed I'm using primarily as an aggregation point.
Mm-hmm.
So I have it you know, linked up to all of the various RSS feeds and things, including Twitter, so that if you kind of want to hit everything I'm doing, you know, this one place. Although I actually got some feedback from someone who said, you know, it would be interesting for you to have a FriendFeed list that was just your work-related stuff. Like, he didn't necessarily want to see the Twitter stuff, and fair enough. So I think I'm going to do something like that as well.
Right.
But that's how I think of that. And I.
Well, they interact. You know, I still use Twitter, and then I go to FriendFeed to see what their comments are on FriendFeed. So they kind of go together. Okay. You know, it's not one war, and then, either or.
Right. And obviously there are competing services to Twitter as well.
Oh gosh,
some of which are technically superior, let's say, but there aren't as many people there. And not to mention the fact that, you know, I've already had whatever number of people kind of follow me on Twitter, and I'm on Twitter, and I'm following.
I wish everybody call it Twitter. There'd be no confusion with Twit, but
I find myself embarrassed to say things like tweet. Like, I'll actually try to describe to my wife occasionally. I just sent this Twitter post.
I just tweeted.
I just tweeted. I sent a tweet, and she looks at me like I have, you know,
like
I have a
you're
problem.
A dweeb, tweet, dweeb.
yeah.
All right, we're gonna.
I don't know.
I know how you feel. My wife has. She looks at what I'm doing and just goes, "I'm sure that's meaningful to some."
Yes, and I'm sure most of those people are sad and lonely.
Sad, lonely individuals. Isn't it funny? Yeah. We work in a world where we know what we're doing, and our compadres know what we're doing, but the normal side of life, you can't even. When has that ever happened? I mean, in the old days, if you were a blacksmith, did you go home and say, "Oh, honey, what a day it's been. I had to shoe a hernia," and she'd go, "Oh, honey, it goes right over my head. Don't tell me about your day." Or I don't think so. I think that we're in a whole new world where
You don't think that wives said exactly the same things they say now, which is does not interest me and you're boring.
They said that. But I think now there's this disjoint between. We're doing stuff that's so abstract and so not connected with physical world that to a lot of people, it's meaningless.
Right. My wife is very polite. She'll actually listen to me blab on about nothing.
Yeah.
And then I have to catch myself and realize I'm being silly because she doesn't care.
She really doesn't care about Randall Strauss. But I do, Paul. You could talk to me anytime. I understand.
You can see her reaching for the phone, you know, 911.
Yeah, or
he's talking about Randall Strauss again.
He's going to have an aneurysm. You can find more of Paul's work and great stuff, too, at the Supersite for Windows, winsupersite.com. He's also news editor for Windows IT Pro. His new book coming soon, the Windows Vista Secrets book from Wiley & Sons, second edition, is on its way. And, of course, we do this every Thursday. You can listen on your iPod or your Zune. by downloading it from the interwebs. We are, on, I believe, on the Zune podcast page, and we're certainly on the iTunes podcast page. Or you can watch us do it live, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. You can see video of Paul and me talking, gabbing away. All the unedited stuff, because it is live. The page is twitlive.tv. Twitlive.tv. And by the way, if you're outside of the U.S. and Pacific and Eastern time zones are completely meaningless to you, it's, that is right. That is 1900 UTC.
We should do everything on Zulu time.
We do. 1900 UTC.
There you go.
I do. In fact, for a while, I was going to set the clock behind me to Zulu. And then somebody said, no, yeah. Because we know what time it is where we are. You should set it to your local time so that we can tell, you know, what time it is where you are. So.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And I'm going to say hello, a little special shout-out to Dink Morgan and all the gang.
To Dink Morgan.
Back at the Country Club. I'll be with you in a moment as we wrap
this
up. Hi, Dink. Thanks, Paul. We'll see you next time
on
Windows Weekly.